the podcast from Belmont Chapel in Exeter, sharing the story, living the life. For more information, go to belmontchapel.org.uk.
So she came there with an alabaster jar of perfume. As she stood behind him at his feet weeping, she began to wet his feet with her tears, and she wiped them with her hair, and kissed them, and poured the perfume on them. Then the Pharisee who had invited him saw this. He said to himself, "If this man were a prophet, he would know who is touching him and what kind of woman she is, that she is a sinner." So Saz made a really good point in her sermon about this scene and the parable which followed it, which I think holds true for many of Jesus' interactions with the Pharisees, who were the kind of theological elite of the day. She said this, I believe I have it. I do. Marvelous. He, that is the Pharisee who had invited Jesus in the first place, probably wants an intellectual discussion about theology and religion with like-minded people, those that he feels comfortable with. But what he gets is a disturbing demonstration of this woman's heart and the power and tenderness of Jesus. And I think we're going to see that idea repeated in today's passage. Chapter 14 tells us about another dinner. This time it's at the house of a leading Pharisee with another seemingly uninvited guest. So let's start by reading just the first six verses, and we'll take it in three chunks. So verse 1. One Sabbath, when Jesus went to eat at the house of a prominent Pharisee, he was being watched. There in front of him was a man suffering from an abnormal swelling of his body. Jesus asked the Pharisees and experts in the law, "Is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath or not?" But they remained silent. So taking hold of the man, he healed him and sent him on his way. Then he asked them, "If one of you has a child or an ox that falls into a well on the Sabbath day, will you not immediately pull it out?" And they had nothing to say. So there is a surprising amount in a very short passage there. So we're going to rattle through it and see how we get on. One Sabbath. Going to stop there. So the Sabbath is the time between sunset on a Friday and sunset on a Saturday. And it's a time where devout practicing Jews refrain from doing work of any kind. And unfortunately, the written law, called the Torah, which makes up the first five books of the Bible, was thought to be too vague on what actually constituted work. So alongside the written law, the scribes, who are sometimes called lawyers, and the Pharisees added some clarifying points which were eventually formalized into what the Jews called the Talmud. And there are two versions of that, one dating from the 5th century AD, known as the Babylonian Talmud, and the other, the Jerusalem Talmud, is of unknown age, but is definitely older than the Jerusalem Talmud and post the biblical era. Now, the idea behind this practice was good. It's effectively what happens here at Belmont every week. It's what we do in small groups every fortnight. It's meeting together and trying to work out what Scripture means for us today. The problem is that the scribes and the Pharisees were focusing on what they could and could not do, rather than what they should and shouldn't do. The result is that priorities are getting twisted, and they're not doing things that are good just because the law says that they're too much like work. So we're on the Sabbath day and Jesus is being watched. When Jesus went to eat at the house of a prominent Pharisee, he was being carefully watched. This isn't just a Pharisee like it was in Luke 7. This is a major player. So the stakes are higher here. And that is not least because we know that the religious authorities are now on the warpath. In Luke 11, verses 53 and 54, so between the two events, we read this. When Jesus went outside, The Pharisees and the teachers of the law began to oppose him fiercely and to besiege him with questions, waiting to catch him in something he might say. It might also be worth noting that, unlike in chapter 7, Luke doesn't specify that Jesus had an invite. I'm going to assume that he did. He certainly wasn't sent away when he arrived. And they'd seem to have set a trap for him, as we'll see in a minute, so they'd want to be sure that he was around. I imagine this was another semi-open house, as Saz put it in her sermon, and that as a well-known teacher, Jesus would kind of be expected to be there. So we continue. There was a man in front of him suffering with an abnormal swelling of his body. Enter our unexpected guest. So this man's medical condition was severe and visible, and like leprosy, it was seen as God's judgment on a person's sin, which, incidentally, you can find in the Babylonian Talmud if you care to look it up. I doubt this man was likely to be welcome in the kind of neighborhood that's home to a prominent Pharisee, let alone at the house. So how did he get here? Matthew Henry's commentary suggests that since it's not stated that he was brought by friends or by the Pharisees themselves, perhaps he was a relative of the host, living now in his care. I find this unlikely for two reasons. Firstly, the man is sent away once he was healed, which suggests he wasn't a resident. Secondly, the parable Jesus tells in verses 12 to 24, which we'll look at in more detail later, indicates that our host may have a thing or two to learn about charity. Personally, I think he was brought by the Pharisees in order to trap Jesus. And the clincher for me is in verse 3, and it's one word, and if you're reading the Green Bibles or the New International Version, you won't have seen it because it's not in there. I'm going to read from the English Standard Version for the next bit. So the first part of verse 3 in the English Standard Version reads, Jesus responded to the lawyers and the Pharisees. So a very quick aside on Bible translation and how that works. There are two major schools. One looks at creating an English text that is easy to read and sometimes loses nuance as a result. And the other looks at creating a text that is as close to the original as possible. And as a result, you sometimes get really clunky, difficult to understand sentences. They both have their merits. If you're doing an in-depth study, I would look at a close to the original text. If you're going to read 5 or 6 chapters at once, go with an easy one. Like, don't make your life difficult. So the reason I mention this is that this word responded, which is rendered in as asked in the NIV, is used 30 times by Luke, and excluding this occasion, on all but one occasion, it is used to denote that the thing that is about to be said has been triggered by or is in response to either an action or something that has been said by someone else. And that one remaining case is in Luke chapter 5, verse 22, where Jesus responds directly to his disciples' thoughts. So this is definitely a response to the Pharisees rather than just asking them a question. And why is that significant? Because the only action so far that Luke has explicitly mentioned is on behalf of the Pharisees, is that they are watching him. So they're watching him, but he responds with a question about healing. To me, that doesn't quite make sense unless they have somehow devised a way to get this man here. So however you think about it, I don't think it's an accident. And Jesus perceives this situation as what they're going to use it for, whether they engineered it or not. And that is, he perceives it as a trap. But watch how he handles it. The first thing he does is not to heal this man, but he asks permission first. He turns to them and says, "Is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath or not?" He asks the people who are literally writing the law whether this healing this man now on the Sabbath is lawful. If anyone knows, it's these guys. Like, they pride themselves on their knowledge of the law. So they're going to give a straight yes or no answer, right? Yeah? No. No, they don't say anything at all. Because if they say yes, then they expose their hypocrisy. And if they say no, they expose their cruelty. So instead they say silent. So having given them an opportunity to stop him, Jesus heals the man and sends him on his way. Now what really baffles me about this encounter is that at no point do they seem to doubt his ability to heal this man. So this medical condition is a retention of fluid in the soft tissue. So it's probably caused by the slow failure of the heart or kidneys. They had no way of fixing that in those days. Like, he could only be healed by a miracle. And they do not doubt that at all. But they are far more concerned with the theology and religion of the situation than the fact that Jesus is about to show incredible power and incredible tenderness. So Jesus poses them another question. If one of you has a child or an ox that falls into a well on a Sabbath day, will you not immediately pull it out? So that's clearly a rhetorical question. Obviously, you want to save a child, and if an animal were to fall into a well and die, that would contaminate the well. That's a public health issue. Well, there are actually spoken tradition rules about whether or not you can save animals on the Sabbath day. It's clearly a rebuke, and that much we can agree on. Jesus is definitely saying, why are you not having more compassion on this man? But if you'll allow me a little leeway, I think it could be a little bit more potent than that. I don't know if you have a little note in your Bible on the word child. Because some manuscripts, some of the original Greek manuscripts, have the word donkey instead of the word child. And this is far less frequent, which is why most English versions read child. But many scholars argue that it fits the context better. And if this is the case, then those traditions about animal welfare definitely apply in this case. And unfortunately, I wasn't able to find a Talmud reference for this one, but I did find a contemporary paper on Jewish laws regarding animal welfare, which reads, "We are permitted to violate the Sabbath to some extent to rescue an animal in pain or at risk of death." If, and I appreciate you may argue this is a big if that original word was donkey, then Jesus' rebuke could be more down the lines of, why do you show more care to animals than for your brothers and sisters who are made in the image of God? But again, they remain silent. So I know what you're thinking. We're 1,751 words, because I've seen you counting, into a sermon entitled Table Talk, and no one has sat down yet. Don't worry, just laying some groundwork. We'll speed up a lot as we look through the rest of it. So, the one thing that Luke, I think, is bringing to our attention here as we move on is that the Pharisees have got their priorities wrong. Just like Saz's quote from the talk that we looked at in the beginning, they are more interested in theology and religion than the plight of a seriously ill man and the tenderness and power that Jesus demonstrates. So let's continue reading verses 7 to 11. When he noticed how the guests picked places of honor at the table, he told them this parable. When someone invites you to a wedding feast, do not take the place of honor. For a person more distinguished than you may have been invited. If so, the host who invited you both will come and say to you, give this person your seat. Then, humiliated, you will have to take the least important place. But when you are invited, Take the lowest place, so that when your host comes, he will say to you, friend, move up to a better place. Then you will be honored in the presence of all the other guests. For all those who exalt themselves will be humbled, and all those who humble themselves will be exalted. So we start this section with a little note that Jesus notices how the guests are sitting at the table. Can you imagine how distressing that would have been for him? This is God in a body, born in a stable. This is a man who knows a lot about humility, who lives humility. And throughout all of history, throughout the scriptures that these men know so well, God chooses humble, broken people to lead his nation. You have Moses, the exiled murderer turned shepherd, who becomes a leader of a nation of free slaves and who is given God's law. You have Gideon, who's a coward hiding in a wine press, who becomes a great general and expels an occupying power. You have David, a young shepherd boy, who is anointed king and becomes Israel's most famous king. And now God in a body watches as the people responsible for the religious direction of his chosen people are practically elbowing each other out of the way to get to a better seat at a table that realistically is only being attended by religious elites anyway. Just to be there would have been an honor. To give you an idea of how mind-blowingly mental this went, I found in the pulpit commentary an example of, there are lots of long names in this, why did I pick this one? At the banquet of King Alexander Janus, the rabbi Simeon ben Shetach, in spite of the presence of some great Persian satraps, that's like a governor, had thrust himself at table between the king and queen, and when rebuked for his intrusion, quoted in his defense, exalt wisdom, and she will make you sit among princes. Like, this is how out of hand this was getting. Again, this was a little bit later, but these are kind of the seeds of the idea that we see in tonight's passage. So this is clearly absurd. And Jesus, with quite a clear, down-to-earth reasoning, explains why this is a bad approach. So a wedding feast in those days would have had no seating plan. Guests would just walk in and sit where they wanted to. And whoever was closest to the host was more honorable than someone further away. That was the idea. But a distant cousin would not have the audacity to go and sit beside the groom, because the best man would arrive and kick him out of his seat. And the only one left would be the one between the toilet door and the really loudspeaker for the PA system that they all had in those days. And it's not only that you'd have this awful seat, it would also be the shame of getting up from top table and walking past everyone else there to the only seat left in the house. Could you imagine the embarrassment? Would you actually sit down, or would you just carry on and leave? Right. But on the other hand, what if an old friend of the bride from school that they haven't seen in years, but they did keep in touch, what if she turns up? And what if their lives have gone down different paths, and perhaps the bride is now on a much higher rung in the social ladder? And the dearly loved friend is just so grateful to be invited to this wonderful feast, and she walks in and she just says, I'll sit here in the corner between the toilet and the loudspeaker. And just before she starts eating, she looks up and she sees the bride standing next to her, and she just says, what are you doing here? I've got a seat for you on the top table. Come on. How much more wonderful would that be to be taken from the place of the most humble and put in the seat of honour. Personally, I'd hate it. I don't really like being the centre of attention, but you get the idea. See, this is a lesson on humility, and it's disguised within a lesson on party etiquette. So a question for you to think about later, before we move on, is we have this somewhat archaic turn of phrase in English. If we call someone proud, we might call them puffed up. I don't know if, is that still used? I'm looking at these people, they all look quite young. Yeah? Yeah. Now, Paul uses this expression in his letters to the Corinthians and the Colossians. I think it would be reasonable that the proud, puffed-up metaphor applies here as well. And assuming that's the case, do you think it's a coincidence that the miracle we've just seen is Jesus healing a man whose limbs are puffed up? Is that just a coincidence? So let's continue with the passage. We're at verse 12. Then Jesus said to his host, "When you give a luncheon or a dinner, do not invite your friends, your brothers, your sisters, your relatives, your rich neighbors. If you do, they may invite you back, and so you'll be repaid. But when you give a banquet, invite the poor, the crippled, the lame, the blind, and you will be blessed. Although they cannot repay you, you will be repaid at the resurrection of the righteous." When one of those at table with him heard this, he said to Jesus, "Blessed is the one who will eat at the feast of the kingdom of God." Jesus replied, "A certain man was preparing a great banquet and invited many guests. At the time of the banquet, he sent his servant to tell those who had been invited, 'Come, everything is now ready.' But they all alike began to make excuses. The first said, 'I've just bought a field and I must go and see it. Please excuse me.' Another said, 'I've just bought 5 yoke of oxen. I'm on my way to try them out. Please excuse me.' Still another said, 'I just got married, so I can't come.' The servant came back and reported this to his master. Then the owner of the house became angry and ordered his servant, 'Go quickly into the streets and alleys of the town. Bring in the poor, the crippled, the blind, and the lame.' 'Sir,' the servant said, 'what you have ordered has been done, but there is still room.' Then the master said to the servant, 'Go out into the roads and the country lanes and compel them to come in, so that my house will be full. I tell you, not one of those who were invited will get a taste of my banquet.'" So this appears to be the last encounter at the table. If you look at verse 25, it seems to move on. And Jesus doesn't pull his punches here, does he? He looks at the host, the one who's put on all this lovely food, and says, "You've invited the wrong people. You should have invited people you don't know. You should have invited people you know are going to be difficult to deal with, and you should have invited them into your home without any kind of protection or professional assistance." And that's the take-home message for us too, right? No, please don't do that. Please don't do that this evening unless you have a very specific call from God. It could lead to some dangerous situations for either you or for your guests. What is Jesus getting at here? I think he makes 2 points. The first is, don't invest in relationships purely for what you can get out of them. And don't assume that heaven is your birthright. We'll come to that one later on when we look at the second section. Verses 12 to 14 cover the first one. So this leader of the Pharisees is organizing a meal for many guests on the Sabbath. This means that food had to be prepared the day before because cooking was considered work, so we couldn't have done that on the Sabbath. It also means that if any of the food is hot, it would have had to be kept warm because you can't light a fire to reheat it on the Sabbath because that is also work. That means that the people who would really appreciate this meal are people who couldn't organize for that to happen themselves. And Jesus lists a few examples of that. The poor, the crippled, the lame, the blind. However, these people don't offer the rich ruler of the Pharisees any opportunity to name drop the people he's had around his house. They're very unlikely to be well educated and able to participate in these religious theological discussions that he seems so interested in. There's no short-term benefit here to inviting these people. On the other hand, if he fills his house with his peers and his superiors, which incidentally are people who can easily afford to arrange for this themselves, then he'll further his reputation, and in that culture he will effectively have bought a seat at their next social gathering. Jesus says, no, invite the people who can't pay you back. It's not about chasing status and reputation. It's about showing love and compassion. Now, that's not to say we shouldn't invite our friends to events and gatherings. It's that we shouldn't exclude people that we find difficult or invite people just because we can get something from them. At this point, another guest chipped in, and I get this picture of a heckler at a big comedy gig. He's the guy in the front row who thinks he's funnier than the person who is literally paid to be funny for a living. Before the meal, the scribes and the Pharisees had remained silent as a man is miraculously healed before their eyes. Jesus had questioned the host's motive in putting on this whole event, and the host has not yet responded and doesn't respond in the rest of the passage. What is going through this guy's head when he stands up and says something to Jesus in the middle of a discourse? But what does he say? He says, "Blessed is the one who will eat at the feast in the kingdom of God." So it might not immediately be clear what he means, but it looks like what this man is trying to do is change the subject. He sees that Jesus might be making the host feel a little uncomfortable. He's trying to bring things around to something a little bit more lighthearted. And what he's effectively saying is, we are God's chosen people, and we're all going to heaven. That's the great banquet imagery. Let's give him the benefit of the doubt and say he was trying to save the host from further embarrassment. And perhaps he succeeds because Jesus' final parable is directed at him. Now, the guests at this party would have known exactly what Jesus meant when he told them this parable. So I'm just going to run you through the imagery that they would have known, and then I'm going to reread it for you and see if you spot anything you didn't spot first time. At this point in history, the image of heaven as a banquet would be very common, as evidenced by the heckler himself. And God would be the host. Now, God had made a covenant with Abraham back in Genesis, and that applied to all his descendants, that they would be his people and he would be their God. So if you're a descendant of Abraham and you follow God's law, you have an invite. Now, invitations in those days to an event like this would come in two parts. You'd have the "I'm having a party" invitation, and you'd have the "everything's ready, come now" invitation. And when you get that second invitation, you've already made preparations for being away for 5 or 6 days, and you just drop everything and you go. There's no second thoughts, there's no rejecting at this point. You just go to the party. You've said you're going to be there. So this second "everything is ready" invitation is an image of judgment day, the end of time, or as the heckler puts it, the resurrection of the righteous. Is that in your version or is that in the English standard? I'm not sure. Those in the streets and fields, they're the people who weren't originally invited. They're the people like most of us who aren't descendants of Abraham. And the people at this party would probably, at least a majority of them, would have looked down on people like us simply because we weren't them. It was a very us-them relationship at the time. So try to hold all of these images in your head. And imagine you're one of the Pharisees hearing this. You're proud to be a Jew. You know the law back to front, and as far as you're concerned, you keep it to the letter. And listen to Jesus' words. A certain man was preparing a great banquet and invited many guests. At the time of the banquet, he sent out his servant to tell those who had been invited, "Come, for everything is now ready." But they all alike began to make excuses. The first said, "I've just bought a field. I must go and see it. Please excuse me." Another said, "I've just bought 5 yoke of oxen, and I'm on my way to try them out. Please excuse me." Still another said, "I just got married, so I can't come." The servant came back and reported this to his master. And the owner of the house became angry and ordered his servant, "Go quickly into the streets and alleys of the town. Bring the poor, the crippled, the blind, and the lame." "Sir," the servant said, "what you ordered has been done, but there is still room." Then the master told his servants, "Go out into the roads and the country lanes. Compel them to come in, so that my house will be full. I tell you, not one of those who were invited will get a taste of my banquet." So what do you think Jesus is saying to the Pharisees here? I think he's saying, you're turning down the invitation. You're not being rejected. You're turning it down with your rules and your religion. Don't assume heaven is your birthright. You are invited, but you have to choose to come. So to close, let's turn to where we started, because tragically from Luke's narrative, it doesn't look like any of the Pharisees moved from there. Can we ask ourselves a question this week? Are we looking for an intellectual conversation about religion and theology with like-minded people that we feel comfortable with? Or are we looking for opportunities for Jesus to show his power and tenderness through us, stepping out of our comfort zone to meet people where they are?